Hi, Eric.
Hello, Aaron.
Part three,
because we don't know when to stop.
I wanted to start today by actually reviewing our Sunday school lesson.
It wasn't Sunday school, Aaron.
Elders Quorum lesson.
There you go.
We had Tanner McAllister teach.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show. Former guest.
Yes.
And was it your idea to present this topic, or was it his?
No. So the way... Aaron is referencing that I'm currently the Elders Quorum president, but the way we do lessons is there's a fellow called to organize the lessons, and he invites people, and he tells them what the Relief Society will be doing that week, and they are free to follow the Relief Society's lead, or if they feel inspired to do something else, they can do something else.
Okay. Do you know what the Relief Society's lead was? Because my wife's down in primary.
Yeah, it's a general conference talk. They do things the right way. So okay. It's a different general conference talk every week.
Yeah, so our lesson was on women in priesthood.
Yes, it was.
Which was very fortuitous.
Yeah, I don't think we had anything to do with that.
Yeah, it's all we've been thinking about, though, over here in Face and Hatland.
Yes.
So I wanted to start here because of a real awesome, is that the right word? Horrifying? Thinking?
Sticky?
Sticky comment from one of our quorum members. So first of all, one of the things that we talked about was the same kind of things that we talked about over the last couple of episodes about women in the priesthood, how there seems to be kind of three different focuses to talk about, right? There's priesthood authority, right? Acting in the name of God to do some task.
Yes, your little breakout group got to summarize our last two episodes.
I did. I did. I definitely cheated in our breakout.
No, you were just prepared.
That's right.
It's not cheating if you're prepared for class.
So priesthood authority to act in the name of God to do something, right? Yeah. Priesthood office, right? Mm-hmm. Teachers, priests, elders, and leadership, which tends to, all three of those things tend to go together, right? And they're not the same thing, but they are. And the boundaries between them feel fuzzy sometimes.
Yeah. They overlap, they connect, but they're not identical.
All right. And then we had a comment from one of the quorum members.
Yes.
That for me, and it was right at the end of the lesson, and for me, it hit like a ton of bricks. Mm-hmm. And he said, he was referring to the fuzziness that I just described, right? And he said, that might be true. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. But he said, there's no decision made by a woman in the church today that can't be vetoed by a man.
Right. The opposite cannot be said.
And that hit like, to me, that hit like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
He said, he followed that up with, that's not fuzzy. That's hard. And I kind of wanted to start here to put a kind of a refresher on one of the themes that we talked about on our last episode, which was the feeling of justice. Like, what is justice when we talk about the priesthood, right?
Okay.
What feels like people are equally served or not? So we've done three episodes now, not counting the Barbie episode, right? And not counting taking the stand. The theme of 6.5, that was definitions. The theme of 6.6, that was feelings. All right? And now we're starting 6.7.
Oh, dear.
And we'll discover what this theme is as we go, I guess. But I wanted to start here about, because I just wanted to draw kind of a knife in the sand, right?
Okay.
It's a horrible analogy.
I don't think that's good for knives.
I want to draw, and I don't know how well of a picture I could do of a knife. I wanted to put a line in the sand. This is really the feeling, right? This feeling
of... Well, this is a fact. Right. This is an incontrovertible fact of the organization of the church. There is no decision a woman can make that a man can't veto.
Yeah. Which goes in stark contrast to a quote from the women's devotional, which stirred up a bit of a kerfuffle.
Okay. I am unaware of the kerfuffle, I believe.
Okay. I thought this might be something to go over kind of as a follow-up part of this. The women's devotional was awesome, by the way.
Yeah, I thought it was good.
Do you watch the whole thing?
I listened to the whole thing at slightly sped up and while slightly distracted. So I can't claim to have heard every word.
This happened on March 17th, 2024. The entire first presidency in the relief of the General Relief Society spoke, which currently consists of Camille N. Johnson, Kristen M. Yee, J. Annette Dennis. And their talks were great. I felt And they also started it with a video. So if you only listened to it, you missed this little
video. No, I did hear the video. I kept going back to say, is this right? But no, it was...
There was like clips of just women doing Relief Society things throughout the world. It was about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was really cool to see all the actual work. It was a really
interesting rhetorical choice because there was no rhetoric, right? Like this is a... You expect when you watch a broadcast like this that people are going to talk the whole time.
Yeah.
And to have this extended opening in which there was no speaking, I thought was a really provocative choice and I think a good choice.
Yeah. I really enjoyed all of the things. I want to read part of it. And I'm going to read from the talk that caused the kerfuffle.
Yeah.
Because I thought the talk was actually really, really good. But I totally see where the kerfuffle came from. So this is J. Annette Dennis's talk, which again, I just want to say this over and over again up front because it's going to sound like I'm going to be critical later.
Okay.
And I'm not. Maybe I am. But my point is that I just want to emphasize that I really appreciated this devotional. All right. First, let's read the parts that were very non-controversial and very welcome, right?
Okay, I'm ready.
First, she quotes from from President Nelson. President Nelson said, "Every woman and man who participates in priesthood ordinances and makes and keeps covenants with God has direct access to the power of God. Those who are endowed in the house of the Lord receive a gift of God's priesthood power by virtue of the covenant, along with a gift of knowledge to know how to draw upon that power. The heavens are just as open to women who are endowed with God's power flowing from the priesthood covenants as they are to men who bear the priesthood," end quote. And then continuing with President Dennis, that's the correct
form. I think they're all called President, yes.
Continuing with President Dennis, "As daughters of God, we can be endowed with priesthood power, the power of God that comes to us as we make and keep priesthood covenants. This has such important implications. As endowed women, we have the right to draw literally on the Savior's power to help help ourselves, help our families, and others." So this was great.
Yeah.
A plus plus, no notes.
And there were a lot of comments like that across the talks.
Lots. The reason why it's so cool is that it goes to this kind of doctrinal foundation of equality between men and women in terms of how they use priesthood power.
Yeah.
Right? That without ordination, women have access to the same priesthood power and authority that men do through the endowment.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting.
Right. And it gets to, this terminology is not historically accurate, but it gets to the fact that the church started out as a pretty feminist institution. And like a lot of things we lost when we were trying to fit in with proper Americans, we gave up on it and lost it.
You are opening and thumbing through a book.
I am. So this is from Midwife of the Wild Frontier. This is a graphic novel about Patty Sessions. Patty Sessions by Melissa Tyler and Luciana Maruca. I made the mistake and bought the black and white copy. I thought the art was black and white and then colored later, but no, it's clearly color art that was rendered black and white for the black and white edition. So if you buy this, spend a couple extra dollars to get the color one. It'll look better. Although it will not make the footnotes any more legible. They are so small, Aaron. They are so small. Anyway, it's a generally historically accurate book. I mean, like all...
Novelizations?
Yes. There's going to be some inaccuracies and like changes, but they're pretty good. If you're into this sort of thing, and many LDS readers of historical fiction are, there's plenty of footnotes to tell you where it's true and where it's not. So here's... the church has changed, Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
So this first sentence will let you know this. "I was given my first of four patriarchal blessings." How many have you had?
I've had one.
Yes. What a standard.
Yeah.
One is standard. I only have known one person in my life that I knew had more than one, and that was because the first one failed to assign them a tribe of Israel, and so they were allowed to get a second one.
Oh, interesting.
Anyway, in their first of four patriarchal blessings, "I was asked often by leaders in positions of authority to go and bless, anoint, and heal others, even when the men were present. When I was 81, so this is much later in the story than where this part of where that's quoted, but when I was 81, Patriarch Charles Hyde told me he had a blessing for me. He then laid his hand on my head and, to my surprise, ordained me to lay hands on the sick, even though I had been anointing and blessing other women for years. And this was typical, right? And what's interesting is...
Okay, some context here. That is old-timey... Like,
this is old-timey. Peggy Sessions joined the church before the trek to Utah.
Okay.
Although that 81-year-old thing would have happened in Utah.
So this would have been in the 1880s, maybe?
No, earlier than that.
1870s?
1840s, probably.
1840s, pretty close to Joseph Smith.
Yeah, she knew Joseph Smith.
Okay.
So in the devotional, a lot of the same terminology is being used, reminding us as a culture that, hey, we have this tradition. Women have the priesthood. Women can wield the priesthood. They're not ordained exactly to, like, deacon, teacher, priest, elder. Like, that's not the system, but they have access to the priesthood and they can do priesthood things. That's largely the message of the devotional. But it's still not quite what Patty Sessions had access to. The idea that Patty Sessions could go and ordain and, like, anoint and heal women and men, even if other men holding the priesthood were present, like, she was asked to go do this because she had the gift of healing and she was good at this, and this is what she was assigned to do. So I appreciate that the rhetoric is pushing us to remember that we have this tradition, but it's not quite as bold as 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s women can wield the priesthood kind of rhetoric.
It isn't quite as bold, and yet you're phrasing that the rhetoric is pushing us towards remembering this tradition. I think it's really important.
I think so too.
It does feel different to me.
I was pretty startled, actually. I knew that somebody had told me about this, and what they told me about the devotional made me think it would say things like this, but I didn't really believe it until I listened to the devotional and heard it myself. But it's pretty explicit, and for more than one speaker. It's clear that this is a choice that is being deliberately made by church leadership.
She quotes,
"And because women can always be vetoed, I feel pretty confident that they have permission from the brethren to use this rhetoric."
For sure. Which is kind of driving to my point.
Okay? I'm sure.
Your phrase there, permission.
Yes.
I'm going to bump on that a little bit. Okay. So I want to quote, though, before we go there. That's a spoiler for a little bit ahead.
Okay.
So now I want to back up what you're saying. President Dallin H. Oakes said in General Conference, "We are not accustomed to speaking of women having the authority of their priesthood in their church callings, but what other authority can it be?"
Right.
And then President Dennis says, "I was so grateful to have this added understanding, and I've tried to teach this truth ever since to women in the circles of my influence." President Nelson said, "As a righteous, endowed Latter-day Saint woman, you speak and teach with power and authority from God." This is awesome stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of, I'm going to speak hypothetically here. I'm remembering of your talk about fiction.
Yeah.
Last time.
Nate Oman's talk.
Nate Oman's talk about
fiction and equity and legislation.
Right. About if you pretend something is real long enough, then it's real.
Right.
So then it counts religiously, right?
Yeah.
So, and that, you know, it was, I'm going to buy all your whiskey for a day, right? Was it Passover?
It's Passover, yes.
Because of Passover, and then I'll sell it back to you, right? It's a fiction, but
It makes things okay.
It makes things okay. I think that to those people that believe that, it's not a fiction anymore, right?
Right. I mean, this sort of thing happens.
Do
you feel like a political example?
I reserve the right to cut any political example.
Okay. So you could argue that this is kind of what the Supreme Court does.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, one of the big trends, of course, in Supreme Court jurisprudence is originalism. The idea being that the text only means what the founders, the people who originally wrote it, thought it meant. Which is a fun fiction all of its own.
Yeah.
But I mean, for instance, you know, the idea that an individual has a right to bear arms, that was only found in the Constitution a little over a decade ago. And right now there are people already doing the work to create what we might call a judicial fiction that if Trump wins in November, that he would be able to run for a third term for various made up constitutional reasons. Nobody in their right mind thinks that the Constitution says anybody can have a third term, right? That I think it's the 28th Amendment. It's very clear on this point. But there are people doing the work to make a fiction, right? To put things in a way that people can choose to believe in. And once it's been done,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, it's done. And so this happens in the Supreme Court all the time. And this is what a lot of, when people complain about liberal judges, that's what they're talking about, right? Finding a right to privacy, and that's a right to abortion in the Constitution. That's a fiction, really. Based on this, the theological definition of fiction. That's what I'm talking about, that we talked about in the last episode. Go rewatch it. Listen. Yeah. So, like, there's a lot of, we see this happening all the time in things other than religion, but the term and explicitly saying what's happening probably makes us a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, and fiction, it doesn't jive well with Latter-day Saints, right? Because we believe in this revelational, revelatory
process. Yeah, we got legislation available to us.
We have legislation available to us, right? And so the point that I'm trying to make here is, it feels like, I mean, how you don't, I feel like there is a world in which you can skip the ordination process for women and still give leadership positions in the future, right? And that to me just kind of cements this whole, like, we didn't ever have to legislate it. It was never really a problem. Now we're going to go ahead and do it this way.
Yeah. Well, and this is kind of what the equity, the third option is.
Yeah.
And what a lot of Protestant faiths have done is, by relying on equity, this idea that, I forget exactly the phrase, and I don't have the article open in front of me, but this idea that if we're making things more equivalent, then that's closer to the way things would be anyway. And that does, although we're really uncomfortable, again, as Latter-day Saints, we want to legislate things. We believe in continuing revelation, so that's our preferred method of doing things. But even if something's legislated, it may accomplish similar tasks as to what equity or fiction might do through another means.
All right, well, we've been hovering on the precipice of this quote here.
Okay, let's hear it.
And again, I really am interested in understanding what Sister Dennis meant by this next paragraph.
Is this the line that caused the kerfuffle?
Sure is.
Okay.
There is no other religious organization in the world that I know of that has so broadly given power and authority to women. There are religions that ordain some women to positions such as priests and pastors, but very few, relative to the number of women in their congregations, receive that authority that their church gives them. By contrast, all women 18 years and older in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who choose a covenant relationship with God in the house of the Lord are endowed with priesthood power directly from God. And we serve in whatever calling or assignment, including ministering assignments, we are given priesthood authority to carry out those responsibilities, and as we serve. My dear sisters, you belong to a church which offers all its women priesthood power and authority from God. Nevertheless, just as he tried to do with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden with the Tree of Life, the adversary wants to focus our attention on what we haven't been given and blind us to all that we have been given. Sisters, generations coming after us will be influenced by the choices we are making now. Let us choose a deeply connected covenant relationship with our Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ, so that we can invite their power, their strength, and their relief more fully into our lives. And just because I want to give this quote the full context it deserves, I'll read the last paragraph as well.
Okay.
I know that the divine privileges and blessings that can be ours as we choose that covenant relationship will bless our children and grandchildren for generations to come. And that's the end of the talk. So, before I editorialize,
okay,
tell me, do you remember listening to that part? Did it jive?
Don't remember that part specifically, no.
Okay.
So I agree with almost all of it, but I simultaneously agree with portions of it as well.
You mean disagree?
Did I say agree twice?
You said agree twice.
Okay, well, yes. It's double positive. That makes a negative, right? I think that's how math works.
Sure.
So, like, I think it's sort of a false comparison comparing to other religions. In the same way that a small percentage of women are ordained, say, among the Episcopalians, a small number of men are as well. So it just doesn't feel like a meaningful comparison. I get the point. And if we accept her manner of thinking about how women have access to priesthood in the church, then her point stands, even if the comparison is a bit unfair. Unfair is not exactly. Anyway, I think I've expressed what I mean. And there was another part that I was a little uncertain about. I can't remember what it was now.
Was it the phrase, focus on what we haven't been given?
Yes, because I know I say this a lot, but that's not a very Joseph Smith-y attitude. And it's not a very Doctrine and Covenants attitude. It's not a very, I mean, knock and it shall be given, or knock and it shall be opened, ask and shall be given. I'm getting screwed up, but you know what I mean. Like, that is not the relationship we have with God. We're supposed to be aware of what we don't have and be seeking good things. So I think that's also not great.
I think there's something subtle in that sentence.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I think there's something subtle in that sentence. Focus on what we haven't been given.
Yeah.
There's an implicit agreement to the conceit. Let me see if I can say it.
Oh, right. I see where you're going. You're right.
There's a tacit acceptance of the premise that there's something missing for women.
Yes.
In that sentence.
I would agree with that.
Okay, so I'm just going to restate that, what she said and what I just said. The adversary wants to focus our attention on what we haven't been given and blind us to all that we have been given.
Yeah.
Implicit in that statement is that there's something missing.
Yes. And I also think that she's not wrong in the sense that we all have things that we haven't been given for one reason or another. And making those things the focus of our existence cannot lead to happiness. However, ignoring those things, I think, is also problematic, possibly even bad. And so it's not an either or. And I would, in any attempt to say that you have to choose between focusing only on what you haven't been given or on what you have been given is a false dichotomy.
I think this is really interesting because I want to understand where she was coming from, because I believe that she said all of these things in good faith, that she was trying to make the situation better for women to help, yeah, to help comfort and guide. Okay. The church later posted this quote: "There is no other religious organization in the world that I know of that has broadly given power and authority to women," on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
They received thousands of comments.
I did hear about this kerfuffle, but I never went to see what the quotation was.
Okay.
15,000 last I heard.
Zero was the last that I heard.
Oh, they put it back up. They said it was...
Oh, they did.
They said it was not an intentional pull down, that it was a error with... I forget the details now. But it's back up, and it had grown to 15,000 comments last I heard.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. Because, yeah, it got lots of responses.
Yeah, and again, I didn't look to see what it was about, because I just didn't feel like it. But I did remember seeing someone on Twitter saying, like, would they put it back up if it had been this number of comments complain about something President Nelson said, which I don't know.
I don't know either. But we don't live in that universe.
No, it's not a relevant comment, really. But it's an interesting question.
It's an interesting question. So big response.
Yeah.
What was what was kind of the themes of these responses?
Oh, no, we haven't, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. it's the idea that there's no other religious organization that I know of that has so broadly given power and authority to women.
Yeah.
Right? I just think it's a disagreement about those words, power and authority. Okay?
Right.
I think that what she is talking about, and forgive me for interpreting a general...
That's what everybody else is doing too.
Okay. Well...
And you're being more generous. So
right? Yeah. The power and authority I think she's referring to is this authority to act in the name of the God to do a specific task.
Yeah.
But I think what other people hear is women can't be bishops.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, or women are excluded from the room, or women can be vetoed.
Yeah, and it happens regularly. Speaking of things on Twitter, Aaron.
Yeah.
Recently, I read a story from someone who had previously been an executive secretary in their ward. Executive secretaries sit in on bishopric meetings along with the bishop, his two counselors, and the ward clerk. Five men.
Yeah.
Generally, many wards, those are the only people who sit in on bishopric meetings. Inviting the Relief Society president has become a lot more common. In our ward, currently, the Relief Society president sits in, as well as the primary and young women's presidents, and me also as the elders' quorum president, which makes for 6 men and 3 women, which is a better balance than 5-0, but not quite even. So they're in this bishopric meeting. The young women who had been preparing a fundraiser for camp for weeks, it was just about to go live. This is about a week before it happens, and the young men had told one of the counselors, whose wife coincidentally was the young women's president, that they were just going to join in with the young women on their fundraiser. Now, the executive secretary, whose wife was also in the young women's presidency, said, no, that's not going to be okay, like, because the activity had been, all the work had been done, everything was prepped, they were all going, it was their fundraiser. If the young men joined, they would get half the money and will have done almost none of the work because it's all finished. And the bishop said, well, there you have it. Tell Brother X that they will have to plan their own fundraiser. But that only happened because a man stood up for the young women. And maybe not the man who should have, the man who brought the request from the young men and who was married to the young women's president, but the executive secretary stood up. And that's the sort of problem that happens.
Yeah. It's so close to being the right message.
Yes.
Of power and authority.
And the thing is, this is why it's really important to study rhetoric, right? Because you can say exactly what you mean, but that doesn't mean that what you said cannot be understood in other ways. There's a lot of ambiguity built into language, and people are going to hear what they think you're saying or what they're afraid you're going to see more often than what you mean, if it's possible for them to do so. Not because people are in bad faith or mean or desiring to mock, you know, fools mock, but because it's just easy to do, especially when our emotions are involved and our previous experiences involved. Like, people are going to misunderstand you, and you really have to be careful.
So that thread's from @SundaySouthern. We're going to have a link to that thread and the Instagram post that we referred to in the show notes. And I think that you're right. I mean, it's the voices in the room, right? That's the power and authority. I think that the people who are interested in this topic are more interested in.
And that's why, even though you have these three categories, and we can talk about how they're different, at the same time, they are not different. If you're not in the room, doesn't matter.
So I put that quote in the in Google, just there is no other religious organization, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And darned if a bunch of articles didn't show up, such as the Salt Lake Tribune.
Ah, our good friend Peggy Fletcher Stack, I assume.
Yep. Well, let's take a look. This is by Tamara Kemsley.
Okay? Oh, I believe that's the young religion reporter who is being primed to take Peggy's place someday.
So the article is called LDS Women Gives More Power to Women Than Any Other Religious Organization Leader Declares. And so it describes the stuff that kind of we've been talking about, quotes the quote, and describes that all Latter-day Saint women are given priesthood authority to fulfill their callings or volunteer positions within congregations and other assignments, right? She said, regardless of whether they have performed the rituals found within the faith temples, okay? So they kind of made the Salt Lake Tribune article sets up the same stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then it gives a similar response to the one that we're talking about here. The quote is, it doesn't speak to the pain, all right? So Elizabeth Ostler, editor-in-chief of the LDS Women Project, pushed back on Dennis' remarks. While I do think it is helpful to recognize that endowed women have the priesthood and are utilizing that priesthood more than we may be aware, this claim doesn't actually address the grievance within our community, she said. Doesn't speak to the pain or desire that many members have about how we talk about, understand, and use the priesthood in our services and our homes, right? And then another quote from Christine Hogland, writer and former editor of Dialogue.
Yes. We've used her stuff before also.
Latter-day Saint women's ecclesiastical authority is dramatically less, she said, than in churches which extend priesthood to women. While distinguishing between priesthood power and priesthood office in this way may feel empowering for many LDS women, Hogland said, the fact that women's priesthood power is exercised exclusively with the permission and at the direction of men who hold priestess office feels constraining and disempowering to many, right?
Yeah.
So that's the important message. One of the reasons why I want to talk about this stuff is so that I can align my own internal compass with the feelings of the people around me and the theology that is taught by the prophets, right? And all you have to do is take this quote, put it into Google, and the first link, well, the third link. No, it's the first link. The first link's the Tribune's response.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And you can immediately see responses like that. Okay, negatives. These are kind of negatives.
Well, it gets to something we've talked about a lot on Face and Hat, this contrast or paradox between two really important ideas to Latter-day Saints. One being that we are all equally children of God. We are all equally able to attain revelation for our various stewardships. We all, in the same way, have something which we could call priesthood power and authority. And we also believe in a hierarchy, which is very top-down, and there are people on top who can, to quote earlier, veto things. This is sort of it's a little like Bug's Life.
All right, now we're talking.
Yeah, so the ants, ultimately, because they all have ant power, are the more powerful entity is the wrong word, the more powerful collective. But the grasshoppers are big and their authority is obvious, and I don't love comparing, you know, the brethren to these violent grasshoppers. But
well,
but the thing is, you look at them and they're big and they're strong, and it's easy to understand their authority as opposed to the authority that all the land share.
But this is why it's so hard to talk about this subject, because what you're describing is exactly what that DNC sanction goes against.
Exactly.
There's no power or authority that ought to be exercised over the children of men, right?
Yeah.
Through the priesthood, right?
And
the priesthood
is not good enough. Yeah. We have found that through sad experience that pretty much everybody does this, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the way hierarchies are and the way humans are. If you put people in a position of power and authority over others, it is so easy to wield that unrighteously. In fact, it takes constant effort not to. It's not just a matter of deciding not to, like, wield it unrighteously. It takes constant vigilance to not wield things unrighteously. And so it's a difficult system, and it requires really good people being really good all the time. And that's not how humans work. There's going to be slip-ups.
You know, it reminds me a bit. There's the word systematic.
Yeah.
Okay? Systematic bias.
Mm-hmm.
Systematic error. Okay? And in my work, I do crystallography.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do is I measure diffraction patterns from crystals. And those diffraction patterns...
And thus tell the future.
And thus I can tell the future. And thus I can solve the structure of atoms.
Yes.
And the patterns, they're gorgeous. They're filled with little spots, right? And what we have to do is measure those little spots. We count up the pixels inside those little spots. Say that spot has a value of 104. This mm-hmm. spot has a value of 17, right?
Okay.
When we do that counting, it's affected by all kinds of sources of error.
Yeah.
And those sources of error, some of them are systematic and some of them are random, okay? So the systematic ones are the ones that are like, okay, actually every pixel on the detector is responding a little bit less than it should.
Mm-hmm.
So let's inflate everything by a little bit.
Yeah.
And that corrects all the data all at once. Right?
Right. Predictable errors. Errors that, if you're careful and thoughtful, you can see.
You can find them.
Yeah.
And then when you eliminate them, it makes all of the data better.
Yeah.
Right? But random error, that's going to be there no matter what.
Yeah.
Okay? And your job is to characterize it. If you can
right.
figure it out, then you can just add that into your measurements and say, okay, I measured 107 plus or minus 3. Right?
Okay.
But you see what I'm saying? So this phrase, the systematic bias,
yeah.
right? When we systematically remove half of the voices, right, from the critical
yeah.
decision makings of the church,
yeah,
right, we don't know what we're missing.
Sure. Right. We could just know that it's missing.
We just know that it's missing. A fact that, again, was implicitly said in this other paragraph. The adversary wants to focus our attention on what we haven't been given, and blind us to all that we have been given. Now, I don't want to play the role of the adversary here, okay? And say that let's focus our attention on what we haven't been given. But the very phrasing implies
yeah.
that there's something missing.
Yes, I appreciate you pointing that out.
And that it could be given in the future.
Sure, absolutely.
Right?
The way Who's going to tell God he can't do that?
The way this is phrased is that we haven't been given something yet.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a statement of this is the theology.
Yeah.
Okay? And this leads me to kind of one of the things I wanted to drive to today. I don't know why women don't hold the priesthood. Okay? But I
yeah.
do know some reasons that can't be the reason.
Okay.
Right?
Sure.
And, you know, these I'm going to list a few of them here, and you can tell me if you agree with them, because I wrote them down. Right? Reason number one.
Reason number one.
Women are fundamentally different than men in the afterlife, right? And so there's
okay.
a theological, unrevealed reason that we do not know as to why women don't have the priesthood.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm giving this
that as... That makes me really nervous.
Okay. That can't be a real reason, okay?
Yeah.
All right? Because even if it were true, which I don't think it is, even if it were true, all that gives us is justification to continue to deny power and authority.
Yeah.
To women, right? Okay. Now the other two. Do you, first of all, what do you think of that?
Well, it...
Okay,
it,
let me just restate it, because I think it was clumsy how I said it. The statement before was, there's something that have not been given to women, but could be given in the future. In other words, there's some theology that has not yet been restored, right?
Okay.
So one of the reasons women don't hold the priesthood, right, is that it's on purpose, it's some reason from God that will be made clear in the future.
Okay, sure.
Right? And the problem with it is that it allows us to justify...
Yeah, it's the exact... I mean, it's just like the race thing, right? There's some special non-earthly reason for us to treat people poorly.
Okay, so a couple other reasons, right? Men need it more.
Yeah, I've heard that one lots of times.
Heard it lots of times. What's wrong with it?
So it's not that different, honestly, from the other one.
Okay. Men need it more, in other words...
Because otherwise we would all be whoring about.
Yeah.
Without the priesthood.
Right. The problem... My problem with this idea...
Yeah.
That women don't need these leadership responsibilities because men need them to be more humble, to be more serving, right?
Yeah.
Is that it's really sexist to men.
Yeah, it is. And I've only ever heard men say this one.
Yeah.
I think it's a form of false humility.
Yeah. So let's just reject that one. Now, the third reason is the one that I find interesting.
Okay.
All right? And it has to do more... And it has to do with this article from... That Tanner sent out.
Oh, as Kathleen part of his Flake lesson, one?
From Kathleen Flake.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about Kathleen Flake?
Yeah, she's a big deal in Mormon studies.
Go ahead.
One of the biggest deals. She's a Latter-day Saint. If you're used to reading apologetics, you would not be able to tell it from her writings, because she's a scholar through and through. She helped found sort of like the modern Mormon studies thing. So, yeah, she's a big deal.
Okay, so here's the reason that I was going to give, the third reason that can't be true for why women don't hold the priesthood, right? There's this idea that women have this responsibility to bring children into the world, right?
Yes.
And this is a through line through lots of LDS talks and discourses over the last 200 years.
Yes.
And I don't want to denigrate that. But if you use that as an excuse for why women don't hold the priesthood, right, then it removes the responsibility of men to participate in the rearing of children, I think. So that's what my response is.
Yeah, any sort of pedestalism, even negative pedestalism, if we're talking about why men aren't good enough and therefore need the priesthood, like it's inherently saying that all children of God are not equally... It's an animal firm thing. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
But this is really hard for me to talk about because this Flake, Sister Flake's article...
Yeah.
Talks a lot about children in a way that's really interesting.
It is interesting.
I have a quote from it. So this is an article from Kathleen Flake, 2009, The Emotional and Priestly Logic of Plural Marriage. And I think this is an extract from the article.
Yes.
That Tanner sent around. Okay. And in this article, she finds doctrine in the interesting place of plural marriage or polygamy. Right. And here's what she gives a bunch of quotes.
And you can be certain that this is extremely well-sourced.
Very well-sourced. Okay? Here we go. Let's begin with the record of an earlier plural marriage ceremony performed by Bishop Newell Whitney in Nauvoo in 1842. Though a bishop in the church, Newell Whitney did not explain his right to officiate in the marriage of his daughter Sarah Ann to Joseph Smith in terms of church office. Instead, he claimed a priestly authority that was both personal to him as a father and broadly held by his family, living and dead. He was, he said, officiating in mine own name and in the name of my wife, your mother. Belief in patriarchal rights to perform marriages had a long tradition, including among the Puritans, from whom most early Mormons sprang. This was largely because civil marriages were considered adequate in light of marriage's temporal character. Marriage was part of God's earthly creation. As modeled in the garden, it was not a heavenly institution. Very uncommon, however, were Whitney's references to the authority of his wife, and secondly, that of holy progenitors. This authority, he stated, was possessed by all of them, by the right of birth which is of priesthood. He announced that this priestly birthright was vested in me by revelation and commandment and promise of the living God, ordained by the holy Melchizedek, and other of the holy fathers. These words tell us that Whitney considered himself and his wife to have divine authority, than that this authority had been passed into them as a birthright from the line of holy progenitors. The birthright, however, actuated or vested in him by separate action related to the Holy Melchizedek Priesthood. So this article is really hard for me to understand. Yeah. but the idea that I got from it, right, was that priesthood back in Joseph Smith time,
yeah,
right, felt really different. And that there was some inherent priesthood in women and men, right? Here's another part of the quote. Significantly, the wife's priestly identity and rights were not derived from the husband's any more than his were from hers. Wives had their own commission, though it was not in effect different from that of the husband.
Yeah.
Okay, and then skipping down. You may remember my earlier reference to Fanny's disappointment that the saints were not taught that the object of marriage was the indissoluble?
Can't be dissolved.
Yeah, the can't be dissolved union of two souls, but rather the increase of children. Elizabeth Kane, an outside visiting Utah, too noted her host's peculiar beliefs in this regard, but with a very telling difference. She records her surprise at a mother's lament for the loss of twin baby girls. It had been, Elizabeth admitted, one of the accepted beliefs from which my mind was stocked before entering Utah, that every mother would be found to regret the birth of a daughter as a misfortune.
Yes.
Right? This is not so. They honestly believe in the grand calling their theology assigns to women, that of endowing souls with tabernacles that they may accept redemption. In Mormonism, the power to birth was related to the power to redeem or to save souls, not merely to numerical increase. Plural marriages, at least as performed in Joseph Smith and Brigham Young's eras, bestowed upon their participants powers that made of childbirth and child rearing priestly acts requiring exercise of salvific powers.
So I've never heard this before, but it makes absolute sense given Latter-day Saint theology. We believe that coming to earth and getting a body is an utterly necessary part of salvation. And so, of course that, you know, bringing souls to earth, giving them bodies, birthing them, of course that's a priestly duty. It's salvific, right? And men do ordinances and women do birth, and neither, you can't be saved without either. So they're equally salvation oriented in that sense. I get all the reasons that people can disagree with that, but it has a coherence.
It has a coherence, and at least feels rooted in the history of the church, right?
It's also another good example of how Latter-day Saints were early feminists, right? Elizabeth Kane, it never occurred to her that a mother could do anything but regret the birth of a daughter.
Yeah.
But early Mormons were like, yay.
Yeah. Because
baby girl.
Women are really important.
Yeah.
Because this is like a priesthood thing that we're doing.
Right. We're creating new people who will fulfill this priestly effort.
I started this part of the conversation trying to list reasons that I would reject for saying why women don't have the priesthood.
Yeah.
Right? And two of them I'm pretty set on. Right?
Yes.
The idea of there's something theologically different about women in the afterlife, right? That would mean they won't receive the priesthood or won't receive authority. Let's put it that way. And the other being that men need it, right? But this third one about child rearing being a priesthood thing, I don't know. I think it's really interesting. But the problem with it is that even if it's true, okay, let's say for a minute that it's really true, okay, that this is that having children is a really, really important thing that is, you know, part of the priesthood and that it's salvific in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. It doesn't change the fact. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't matter because men can still veto women.
Yeah. And also, Kathleen Flake makes a point that this is about plural marriage. And you read about plural marriages and, men were not in touch with all their wives all the time. And child rearing was very much something women did.
And this has been soundly rejected by the church, actually, this whole part of our...
That aspect of it, yes.
Yeah, the polygamy part and...
And the part about birth has just been ignored because it's awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps.
I don't know. I'm not sure that I'm getting to a specific conclusion here.
Well, how about this?
Except that it's interesting.
This is from the volume on Jacob in the Brief Theological Introductions series. There's one for Well, I want to say each book of the Book of Mormon, but that's not quite true. Enos, Jerem, Omni, Sherah book, and Alma split into two volumes, third and fourth Nephi are combined. But essentially, a book per volume. This one's by Deidre Nicole Green, and I really love what she has to say about Jacob, and some of the insights are really great. Largely how Jacob just is really big into equality. Jacob is really big into community and how salvation is something that we share as a community and something we work towards together. So here is a sentence that I think captures a lot of what we're talking about. This is not necessarily about what we're talking about. It's not about women in the priesthood per se, but I think it's applicable. The take-home message from Jacob seems to be this. Failure to take at face value the overarching theme of equality and justice in Scripture in order to justify selfish whims, or for any reason for that matter, is destructive not only to one's individual soul, but also to an entire society. Scriptures are very clear that we are all equal. Male and female, black and white, bond and free, we are all equal. And when we fail to take the Scripture seriously on that point, it impacts not just our individual salvation, but it impacts our entire society. And that's kind of what all of the Book of Jacob is about. It's like, hey, if we treated women equally, if we saw the Lamanites as our equals, if we saw this Antichrist as someone worth listening to, maybe we would be better people. And Jacob demonstrates that over and over again.
I feel so clumsy talking about this subject. Yeah. I feel so inarticulate.
Yeah.
I feel so stupid.
Well, I think our culture's done a good job of coming up with excuses so we don't have to dig into it. And we're now on our third hour, I think, of talking about this. We've run out of vocabulary. I mean, obviously there are a lot more women who've written about this that we could be engaging with, but there's only, we don't have the capacity to reach conclusions, you and I. Here's an anecdote for you. Okay. I mentioned really briefly, and at a moment where it might have gotten edited out, that I had recently read a book, I didn't read the whole thing, but I read the entire section about B.H. Roberts. B.H. Roberts, early Utah era 70, like early Utah 70, when he was in the presidency of the 70, he ran for Congress, he was elected, he was never seated. Congress refused to seat him, and after a lot of circus, they rejected him and refused to let him be a member of the House. But he was accompanied on his trip to D.C. by his daughter, and it's unknown whether this was an intentional choice of his, but everyone was really kind of disturbed by her. She was a very beautiful young woman. She was very intellectual and well-educated. She bore herself really well. She had very fine etiquette. She dressed well. She spoke well. She could not be flummoxed. A lot of the rhetoric about why polygamy was bad, and for the record, I do think polygamy is bad, but the reasons that the rest of America gave had to do with how it's bad for women and how it's degrading and we have to protect American womanhood, et cetera, et cetera. And her excellence as a human being made all those arguments really hard to accept. Anybody who met her was not prone to agree. They could still hate the Mormons and still hate polygamy, but the common arguments that were thrown out just didn't stand up because here was this woman who was from this allegedly oppressive culture that was destroying womanhood, and she was awesome, and just a few minutes in her presence showed people that she was an amazing human being. So where do we go from here? I don't know, but I think that from our kerfuffle comment, the point is a good one, in that because things aren't yet what they might be, and equality might not be as fully realized as Jacob might encourage us to attempt, it doesn't change the fact that there's a lot of good. And the women of this church are excellent. And you run the risk whenever you say things like that of engaging in these excuses for why women don't have the priesthood, like they're so good they don't need it sort of thing. But just because that's a lousy and lazy excuse does not take away from the excellence of the people the excuse is supposed to be covering up for.
I feel like it's worth recognizing at this moment.
Yeah.
How good this devotional was.
Yeah, if you think that, yeah, if all you know is that quotation,
yeah,
they're really pushing the rhetoric in a new direction. I was frankly startled. They were saying a lot of things that I only expected to see on Feminist Mormon Housewives or something like.
Yeah.
They didn't push it as far as some people would like to go, and that will always make some people upset, but they pushed things pretty far compared to what I expect to hear.
Yeah, I really want to emphasize that because as I said in the beginning, I knew it was going to sound like I was being really critical of this quote, right?
Yeah.
But all I'm really being critical of is the recognition of the word power and the word given and things like that. Those words have different meanings to different people, right? And that is important. It's just really, the language is moving towards a really good place.
Yeah.
And it's so good in the rest of the devotional that it's really worth, worth listening to. So where do we go from here? We've done three of these.
Yes, we have. Is three enough?
Maybe.
Well, how about this, Aaron? I don't know what a fourth part would be about at this point. I'm not sure you do either.
No.
I'm not opposed to a fourth part if there's something else to say that we should cover. That's why we have a Discord channel.
But yes, it is.
People can tell us if we miss something important that we need to talk about before we leave it alone.
We're going to end on the same question that we started with, right?
Well, I said, we can't resolve this.
Why don't women hold the priesthood?
This goes back to one of our previous episodes this season about advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the advocacy episode. There's certain things that we are not in a power to solve, and it's really not our job to worry about them. Like, because the church is hierarchical in nature, it's somebody else's job. But we can't also ignore the pain that people experience because of these issues. Something from the last episode, when Elder Bragg was talking about the handbook, he didn't say this explicitly, but sort of like the non-explicitness of this quotation, he made it pretty clear that the way the handbook changes is people talk to their stake presidents, and stake presidents talk to the area authorities, and the area authorities send it on up, and it gets considered, and changes to the handbook are always happening. Like, revelation does go every direction in this church. We are all revelation receiving, priesthood wielding children of God in this church. Let's not forget that, even if we're not sure what the end point looks like.
All right. Thanks, Eric.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron.
Interesting conversation. We leave, like so many of these, we leave it unresolved. It's interesting. I love diving into some of the deeper, weirder doctrines of the church, right? Mm-hmm. But this topic, there's something about it. The vibe is just different, right? A lot of the topics we focus on are like
esoteric. They don't touch anyone directly.
They don't really matter that much.
Yeah.
Like, they don't really matter because they're not salvific, right?
Yeah, right.
But this one has a different vibe to it, right? It has a different, like, I feel like I want to be careful. I don't want to offend, right? But I also don't want to not say anything. I also am generally interested and confused.
Yeah.
And like, I genuinely want to know the reason why the church is organized the way it is. And any answer to me is fine. But the fact that we don't know, I mean, whenever I find something I don't know, I just want to chew on it. Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I've been wanting to spend a bunch of time on this topic. So thanks for coming with us.
Yeah. It's
well chewed. Our music's by Daniel Foster Smith. Follow us on Discord. Join our server and chat about it.
Yep.
And thanks.
Listen, if we take too long, listen to something else in the Dialogue family of podcasts.
Of which we're a proud member.
We are indeed.
All right. Bye.
Bye.